Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Hello, this is Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and tonight I'm talking to Nessa Carey. Nessa Carey has a PhD in virology from the University of Edinburgh and has worked in the biotech industry for nearly 10 years. She was previously a senior lecturer at Imperial College School of Medicine in London. She is the author of The Epigenetics Revolution: How Modern Biology is Rewriting Our Understanding of Genetics, Disease and Inheritance. So I'm joined today by Nessa Carey. Nessa, thank you very much for joining Little Atoms today.
Great pleasure.
We're going to be talking about your book, The Epigenetics Revolution. Before we talk about what epigenetics is, I think we should have a brief recap on DNA.
No worries. So DNA is basically our genetic script. It's our alphabet. It's an alphabet that's just got four letters, but because it's 3,000 million letters long, it can code for a huge amount of information. And that's our script, our blueprint. It's what encodes the most basic things about us. And that's where we have the genes that code for the proteins that do all the work within our cells, or at least that's what we used to think did all the work within our cells. Epigenetics tells us there's something else as well. And the DNA blueprint or script is fantastically important. If it's wrong, then you can end up with devastating genetic disorders. Ones like cystic fibrosis, Duchenne muscular dystrophy, all sorts of really clinically damaging disease, which most of us don't suffer from. Most of us do not have those sorts of genetic problems. But all of us ultimately tend to get disease of one form or another, especially with an ageing population. And what we know is that those are not caused by changes in our DNA. Our genes, on the whole, tend to stay the same most of the time throughout most of our lives. So we have this strange paradox where we have an absolutely stable and consistent DNA script, perfect alphabet, and yet something still goes wrong. And that's because it's not just the DNA script which is important.
So let's talk about epigenetics. What do we actually mean by that? What does the word mean?
Okay, it means two different things, just to make it really confusing. Luckily, the word itself is quite useful. So epi comes from the Greek, and it basically means on top of, as well as, in addition to. And actually, scientists have known for a really long time that there was something else in addition to the genetic code that was important. And we know this from looking around us, and we know this from various experimental systems. And I'll give you a few examples, if you like. So every cell in our body, and there's about 50 trillion of them, has exactly the same DNA genetic code. So that script in each cell of our body is exactly the same in all the cells. But the cells are very different. So there's no teeth in our eyeballs, and that's because teeth know to be teeth and eyeballs know to be eyeballs. So that's an example of where all these things, all these cells have the same genetic code and yet they're different. So there's something that's happening in addition to the code on top of it. Although the cells that make our teeth and the cells that make our eyeballs have exactly the same genetic code, they don't use it in the same way. And there are loads of examples of this in nature. If you look at a caterpillar and a butterfly, they've got the same genetic code because they're the same individual, but they don't look the same. Mm-hmm. And these are called epigenetic phenomena. And what it means is every time you see two things which are genetically the same but aren't the same in appearance or behaviour, which we would refer to as phenotypic, if they have phenotypic differences despite the fact they're genetically identical, scientists call that epigenetic. We know loads of examples of this. So, for example, identical twins, where one develops schizophrenia, one doesn't. That's epigenetic.
But, of course, identical twins do look the same. Obviously, they're not the same person. They're two different people with individual personalities, etc. But, yeah, I was going to bring us on to twins next, really, because that is a sort of great example. They're not the same person, but they do have the same genetic.
They have exactly the same genetic code, so they should be identical. Mm. And they're not. And you can also do a bigger version of that in experimental animals. So you can create mice who are genetically identical, and you can create those in large numbers. And you can keep a colony of those mice, all of which are genetically indistinguishable, in exactly the same environment, and yet they won't all have the same body weight. There used to be an expression called intangible variation that was used to describe this, but it's basically called an epigenetic phenomenon. So something as well as the genetic code that leads to differences between two identical things. We've known about those sorts of phenomena for a long time. What we didn't know before were the explanations for it. And that's what's different now, and that's what's really the revolutionary aspect of all this, is we're starting to understand what epigenetic phenomena are caused by at a molecular level. Mm-hmm. And handily, given that epi means on top of or as well as, what these are caused by in many cases are modifications to our DNA template. So our genes get slight modifications on them. They don't change their sequence, so those four letters in the alphabet remain exactly the same. But you can actually stick a small chemical group onto one of those, and it changes the way in which genes are used. The other thing that we understand now and we didn't used to was that DNA, we think of it as, we all know about the double helix. Everybody's seen pictures of the double helix. DNA isn't quite like that in cells. It's wrapped around proteins called histones. And we used to think that the histones were just there to help the DNA squash down so it could get into a nucleus. But actually what we now know is, as well as DNA getting little chemical modifications on it, those histone proteins can also get little chemical groups added to them. And those also influence how individual genes are expressed. And these are epigenetic modifications. So now we have the phenomenon and we have the mechanism.
So there's a term in the book called DNA methylation. So yeah. Is that what you're talking about?
That's the main change that happens to DNA itself rather than the proteins. Mm-hmm. And all that is one carbon atom with three hydrogen atoms gets stuck onto one of the letters of the alphabet, which is the base called C in DNA, one of the building blocks. If you get a region of a gene where most of those letter Cs have got this methyl stuck on them, this DNA methylation, then that tends to be associated with switching those genes off. And because that pattern of where those small methyl groups go is different in different cells, it allows some cells to turn on some genes and keep others turned off, and other cells to have a different pattern.
So let's look at, try and sort of describe the ways that this happened. And there's a great visual metaphor in the book, which is the DNA landscape metaphor.
Yeah, this is a metaphor that came up from a man called Conrad Waddington back in the 1940s, 1950s. And he was one of the last great polymaths. And he was looking at developmental biology. A lot of our understanding of epigenetics has come out of developmental biology, and it's an area where UK science has been particularly strong. And essentially, he said, you start with one cell, and then that divides, and then those daughter cells divide. And that's how you get from one cell to 50 trillion in a human. But as those cells divide, they start becoming more and more specialised. And what he visualised was a ball at the top of a hill, and a very craggy kind of a hill. And as this ball rolls down the hill, it might get deflected by a little hillock and go to the left a bit, or to the right a bit, and it may end up in a different position at the bottom of the hill each time you roll this ball down. And what Waddington said was, this is what happens to cells. As that first starter cell divides and its daughter cells develop, they start moving down different developmental pathways, which take them into different routes, and they become more and more specialised. And one of the most important things about that is, once they get to the bottom of the hill, when they get there, we can all visualise what happens. It's just like rolling a marble mm-hmm. down a slope. Once it's at the bottom, it's not going to go back up again. And it's also not going to go, if you imagine the hill as being very sort of like a volcanic landscape, lots of little crevices and so on, the marble or the ball isn't going to jump from one of those crevices into another. It's going to stay where it was. And that's what happens to our cells. They, on the whole, go down a landscape, they develop down particular routes, and when they get to their end point, when they're a fully developed, fully differentiated kidney cell or liver cell or white blood cell, that's what they stay being. And that's why you don't get teeth in your eyeballs, because they're not going to jump from being teeth cells into being eye cells.
But you talk about a way in which we have discovered to basically move those marbles from the bottom up towards the top. And you talk about an experiment by a scientist called John Gordon with toads. Tell us about that.
Okay, so he's this amazing man who I think is now in his 70s or possibly even early 80s, still working in research in Cambridge, although he now works in an institute that's named after him, which I think must be pretty cool,
actually.
Yeah,
that's a pretty good place to work.
What he did was to examine a really fundamental hypothesis, and it was his work that led to this whole explosion in the field. If you look at those cells, which are like our marbles or our balls, at the bottom of that landscape, you could say, well, why have kidney cells become kidney cells? Why have liver cells become liver cells? And you could think, well, maybe the kidney cells have just got rid of all the genes that they don't need. You know, what's the point of a kidney cell producing antibodies? That's not its job. Other cells do that. And maybe the liver cells have got rid of all the genes they don't need. And that's a perfectly reasonable hypothesis. John Gurdon investigated that by taking out the nuclei from adult toad cells, so maybe from their skin, and taking out the nucleus that contains all the genetic information and putting it into a toad egg. So he took the nucleus out of a toad egg, got rid of it, put in the nucleus from a differentiated cell, one of these ones that's fully developed, and looked to see if any new toads would develop. He was an incredibly patient man and fantastically good technically. And what he was able to show, and show quite convincingly, was that actually those cells, those adult cells that he'd taken the nuclei out of, if you put them back into the egg, which is essentially that first, very first stage, they could sometimes generate entire new toads. And what that showed us was that the nuclei of those adult cells, which are right at the bottom of this landscape, they keep all the genetic material that they started with. They don't lose any of it. They keep it, it's always there, it still has the potential to be used again. And that's how he was able to generate entire new toads just from that one cell.
And so what happens? I mean, it's essentially reset, sort of, yeah, all that data is wiped clean.
Absolutely. It's as if you've taken one of those marbles at the bottom of the ramp and you've pushed it all the way back up and you've taken off all the epigenetic modifications, all those little additions to the DNA and to the histone proteins. You strip all of those off and it goes back to being like a nucleus from an organism that's just been fertilised from a sperm and egg that's just fused.
Do we know what it is that's actually making that happen?
We don't know as much about it as we'd like to, which is quite remarkable when you consider how long people have been working on this. We do know there are certain genes that are absolutely key for this. And the other thing that we know is that there are certain factors which are present in the egg. Mm-hmm. You can't just take a nucleus out of an adult cell and put it into some other cell type and create new animals. The egg comes preloaded with various probably proteins, RNA molecules. We really don't know very well, which initiate this whole process, this whole taking off of one set of epigenetic markers and putting on another set. What we do know is that there are four proteins which are absolutely critical. And the reason that we know this is because of experiments that were carried out only about 5 years ago in a Japanese lab by a man called Shinya Yamanaka. And what he did was he was able to show if he took just four particular genes and expressed those really highly in adult cells, he could actually turn those back into cells just like that first single cell, essentially like embryonic stem cells. So we know there are four genes that have to be expressed to make this work.
So this, what we're doing, what he's doing here basically takes us to clones. This is where,
oh,
this,
yeah,
is the method that was used. This is where Dolly, yeah, the sheep comes,
yeah,
from.
Yeah, this is completely where Dolly the sheep comes from. It's an absolute descendant of that work of John Gurdon's. That's what showed it was possible.
What's interesting about clones is that, A, it's, they're incredibly difficult to make. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of clones get made before, mm-hmm, you end up with a living clone. But then that one, Dolly, was, you know, had terrible arthritis. They, yep, tend to be particularly unhealthy.
They do. And we think that the reason that that's the case is because when you take a nucleus from an adult cell and you put it into one of these sort of empty eggs, what happens is all those factors in the egg which are important for taking, for really creating the process where you can generate an entire new individual. They do their best to work on the nucleus and the genes from an adult cell, but essentially an adult cell nucleus isn't quite right. It's not the same as a nucleus from an egg and a sperm, which would normally form to make a new individual. So what happens is the environment of the egg is good enough to take out most of the epigenetic modifications that have made, for example, a mammary cell, because that's what they use to make Dolly the sheep. But it can't quite do it perfectly. It's just too tough a hurdle to cross. It can do it well enough that you can create the new clones, although, as you say, at really low frequencies, it's still not routine. But it can't do it quite well enough to get rid of all the sorts of changes that may have accumulated over the years. And that's consistent with the fact that we think a lot of chronic disease and disease associated with ageing is actually caused by our epigenetic modifications, mm-hmm, going a bit haywire in our cells.
Well, moving on from that, an interesting phenomenon is that the offspring of clones, if clones then go on to have offspring, those offspring tend to be not just healthier, but,
yeah,
particularly robust.
Absolutely. I mean, back in 2010, there was a very short period where there was this uproar about the offspring of cloned, mm-hmm, animals had
getting
got into
the
human food chain. And that calmed down really quickly, actually. People were very rational about it. Because we think what happens, or we're pretty sure what happens, is when you make the clones, you can't quite get the epigenetics right. You can't quite take off the right modifications, put the right modifications back on. By you, I mean the egg. Can't quite do it. So the clones themselves tend to be a bit ropey in terms of their health. But when those clones themselves produce eggs or produce sperm, depending on their sex, those eggs and sperm are produced in exactly the same way that they would be in any other mammal. And that process is very, very good at taking off various epigenetic imprints or marks, putting the new ones on, and creating just exquisitely poised and ready genomes that are marked in all the right places with all the right epigenetic modifications. And so that's why the offspring of clones tend to be perfectly healthy and indistinguishable from any other offspring of the same species.
You're listening to Little Atoms, today with me, Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Nessa Carey about her book, The Epigenetics Revolution. So Nessa, I want to talk about, there's a period of history you talk about called the Dutch Hunger Winter. So let's describe what that is.
So this was a period in the Second World War. It was basically the last winter of the Second World War, and certain bits of the Netherlands were still under German occupation. And basically there was a blockade, and it was also an incredibly bitter winter, so the canals froze. And it became impossible to get a decent amount of food to the Dutch population. Probably about 20,000 people died as a consequence of this. The population were desperate. They were eating grass, tulip bulbs, anything they could to stay alive. It was obviously an appalling time in sociological terms for that population, but it created an extraordinary study population scientifically, because all those individuals suffered one period of malnutrition in their lives. And also they were part of a country which had a very good health structure and very good monitoring. And people began to monitor the outcomes of what happened after the Dutch Hunger Winter. And the oddest thing that happened was related to the children who were born just after it. Now, most of us are aware that our fetuses put on the greatest amount of weight in the last 3 months of the pregnancy. So the initial thought was that those would be the fetuses who, as children and as adults, might have the biggest health problems. If they'd been in the womb during the Dutch Hunger Winter, they wouldn't put on weight normally in the last 3 months, and they'd be born very underweight. And there were many underweight children born. But what we found is a really quite bizarre thing. The children who were in the womb during the Dutch Hunger Winter during the first 3 months after conception are actually the ones who seem to have had the longest-term health consequences. So those children were born at perfectly healthy weight because later in the pregnancy, their mothers had access to food. But despite the fact they're born at perfectly healthy weight, they're the ones who, as adults in particular, have been more likely to have health problems, in particular problems such as obesity and diabetes. And it looks as if what's happened is something in the fetus has been programmed by this stage in their development when they had very poor nutrition. I think one way of visualising it is almost as if what's happened is the fetus has been sent a signal saying there isn't enough food around. And then as those individuals have matured, their body still continues to believe there isn't enough food around, and they've become programmed in some sense that we don't understand terribly well to make the most of nutrition. Mm-hmm. And consequently, they have this higher risk as adults of being obese and of metabolic disturbances. The really odd thing is that this effect is carrying on into their children. So their children have not been through any period of starvation developmentally, and yet they're still inheriting something from their parents. Now, we know this is not going to be due to mutation because it's happening too commonly. Mutation only happens at certain rates. So this is a phenomenon where something that one individual didn't experience but their parents did is being passed on not because of mutation. This is actually an appallingly radical thought, because this is Lamarckism. This is saying these children are inheriting an acquired characteristic, and that causes quite a stir.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to point out, you know, we at Little Atoms pride ourselves on our discerning audience, and there will be people at home listening and going, hang on, there's a heresy here. How is this?
Yeah, no, they're absolutely right. There is. And it's surprising the number of people working in epigenetics who will describe themselves as neo-Lamarckists. They don't for a second, as no more would I, believe that Darwinian evolution is an incorrect hypothesis. I think almost anybody accepts that that is the defining theory.
We should perhaps briefly recap on what Lamarck's theory was.
Yeah, so Lamarck had this perfectly rational theory, which was that you needed to explain how inheritance happened. And his theory was that parents passed on to their children characteristics that they had acquired. And the classic example that he gave was that the children of blacksmiths had big muscles, just like the blacksmiths had. And so his assumption was that the blacksmiths had worked very hard, built up their muscles, and they somehow passed this on to their children. Now, our interpretation these days, of course, is entirely different. And our interpretation is that people who became blacksmiths were probably quite muscly anyway, so they passed on that distribution to their kids. And also, the kids probably had to start helping out in the smithy as from a very young age, so they bulked up. And of course, once we started to understand Darwinian theories and Mendelian inheritance, so inheritance of genes, Lamarckism made no sense whatsoever and was very discredited. And sometimes we're a bit smug about it. We pretend Lamarck was just an idiot, and he wasn't. He was making a genuine attempt.
But that blacksmith one is a particularly rubbish example.
It is a fairly rubbish example. Yeah, it's true. But you know, you've got to give the guy some credibility. He at least had a go. So there's been this dogma that sort of inheritance simply does not happen because it can't happen. Mm-hmm. Because of what we understood about reproductive biology and genes and so forth. But it's clear from situations like the Dutch hunger winter and from some very convincing work in mice that just occasionally this does happen.
You talk about an example from Sweden as well. Let's talk briefly about that.
So there's an example from Sweden which is actually even better in some ways in terms of demonstrating that you get this kind of inheritance. And the reason it's better is because it comes through the father. So with the Dutch hunger winter, what we mainly have been looking at are effects that are transmitted from the mother, and that makes for complications because there's all sorts of issues about nutrition in the womb, etc., and how that may be influenced. There was an area of northern Sweden which, back in the 19th century in particular, tended to have real feast or famine in terms of harvest. And also, just like Holland really, had an infrastructure that was very good in terms of record keeping. And what scientists did was to go back and to look at the health outcomes for the children and grandchildren of men who had been alive during these periods of feast and famine. And they look at a particular point, which is the point just before puberty. And this is where boys tend to do most of their growing. Yeah, that's the real growth spurt stage. And what they found was that if a man had been alive at a period where there was a huge amount of food, and so they would overeat because you had to. You just, you know, if you didn't eat it, it went to waste, so you ate when it was there. Men who had overeaten when they were boys at this stage, just before puberty, their sons and their grandsons were again at much higher risk of obesity and diabetes in particular. And again, it was happening far too frequently to be explained by mutation. They are passing something on that is a consequence of their experiences. And again, we have reasonably good evidence from rodent models that this is happening too. So some work has come out within the last year showing very similar phenomenon. And really, this because it can't be explained by mutation, so it can't be explained by changes in the DNA because it's happening at much too high a frequency, it's thought, and there's some preliminary data coming out, that this epigenetic phenomenon is also caused by an epigenetic molecular mechanism. We think these fathers in particular, or the mothers in the Dutch hunger winter, have passed on some of these particular modifications on the DNA or on the histone proteins to their children, and that's what's priming them to be at higher risk of obesity.
Let's talk a little bit about the implications for medicine, for instance. What sort of things can it be used for? And I'm particularly interested in looking at its implications in the fight against cancer.
Yeah, epigenetics is of enormous interest in cancer, both to academic labs working in this and also to big pharmaceutical companies and biotech companies. And it's because we know that in a number of cancers, something has gone wrong with the epigenetic programming in those cells. We know this for a number of reasons. We can actually detect this. For example, we can look at patterns of DNA methylation in these cells in cancer, and we know that certain patients have completely abnormal patterns of DNA methylation. And the reason that that's important is because that means you change the gene expression. And what tends to happen is that in cancers, you have overexpression of genes that cause lots of proliferation, and you have underexpression of genes that would tend to hold the cell back and stop this adverse proliferation. One of the reasons there's so much excitement around this as well is because we've been able to develop drugs that actually treat cancer patients by inhibiting some of these key epigenetic enzymes. In both cases, the drugs were shown to have effects in cancer cell lines long before anyone realised they were actually working through epigenetic modifications. So it would be nice to think we had this really rational approach, but what actually happened was compounds were found that were interesting, and only later did we realise what they were doing. So that's created a great deal of enthusiasm, and there are four drugs on the market which now are licensed for use in human cancers. They're not going to be the only drugs that are developed. And the reason I say that is because although these drugs work, they only work in certain types of cancers. And we actually don't know why. We don't know why some cancers are particularly susceptible to these and others aren't. The good thing is there are probably at least 300 different proteins which are important in epigenetics, so we've got lots of other opportunities to create compounds that inhibit some of those other proteins and find new ways into treating cancer. So it's a very useful addition to the drugs that we can use for cancer.
Well, we're nearly running out of time, but just to finish off, I'd perhaps just like to spend a little time talking about, do you think there's any sort of danger in the rush to put lots of our behaviour and lots of things that happen with us down to genes and rather than sort of other social causes? And the reason I raise this is specifically because there was an article in the Daily Mail a few weeks ago which was actually turned out to be a really good write-up of the book, but was headlined, "Is Audrey Hepburn the Key to Stopping the Obesity Epidemic?" The answer to which is clearly no. Audrey Hepburn, because she was brought up during the Dutch hunger winter, we should probably say. As I said, it turned out to actually be, you know, full of really, really good science, that article, and gave a good overview of the book. But it seemed that headline fitted very much into what I would expect to be the Daily Mail's normal script for talking about this sort of medical issues.
Yeah, I think we have to be incredibly careful about not oversimplifying. We do know that epigenetics has a big impact on a lot of conditions, including ones which have a behavioural component, for example, neuropsychiatric disorders, particularly when it comes to, say, people who have had abusive or neglected childhoods. And yes, that gives us a mechanism, but all that's giving us is a readout. What I would be really concerned about on a personal level would be anything that suggested that just because we know something has a physical basis means we no longer have to take any responsibility at a social or a personal level. And it's the same thing for me with the obesity epidemic. We know that what our parents and grandparents ate influences our outcomes, but that doesn't give us any excuse to live on chip butties and burgers. You know, we still have a lot of ways that we can influence our own outcomes. There are occasions in which we are completely genetically determined. If you have a particular mutation, you will have a certain form of dwarfism, for example. There's nothing you can do about that. But something like epigenetic alterations and control of gene expression, it's a very important but very subtle system. I mean, that's exactly what it's for. In some ways, it's to modulate how we respond to our environment. So we still have an enormous personal responsibility and societal responsibility to ensure the best possible environment, in every sense of the word environment, to give our bodies the greatest chance of being healthy.
So I've been talking to Nessa Carey about her book, The Epigenetics Revolution, which is out now from Icon Books. So Nessa, thank you so much for talking to Little Atoms today.
Thank you ever so much for the invitation. It's been great.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests at our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.